Olá, eu sou a Vera Magalhães. Você está ouvindo o Roda Viva em versão podcast. Todas as terças-feiras, confira o programa na íntegra nos principais tocadores de áudio. Olá, boa noite. Sejam muito bem-vindos ao Roda Viva. Estamos no ar para todo o Brasil pela TV Cultura e emissoras afiliadas. Você também pode assistir ao programa de qualquer lugar do mundo por meio das diversas plataformas digitais e do app Cultura Play. Não é todo dia que temos a possibilidade de entrevistar aqui, no estúdio do Roda, o detentor de um prêmio Nobel. O nosso convidado de hoje recebeu a Láurea em 2001. Quando foi um dos responsáveis por desenvolver a teoria dos mercados com informações assimétricas. Seus estudos se mostraram ainda mais certeiros com a crise dos mercados em 2008 e inspiraram movimentos de contestação ao capitalismo global, como o do Occupy, nos anos seguintes. Este programa está sendo gravado em 14 de setembro, por ocasião da sua vinda ao Brasil, a convite da Oxfam Brasil e do Instituto de Estudos Socioeconômicos, para uma agenda de diversos eventos em que abordou temas como justiça tributária e desigualdades. Ele é um defensor de uma gestão da economia que leve em conta a prosperidade compartilhada, e um crítico severo do liberalismo laissez-faire e ao financismo global. Em relação ao Brasil, país com o qual mantém uma profícua e antiga relação, tem defendido que o presidente Lula está correto na sua cruzada contra os juros altos, e que a reforma tributária é indispensável não só para corrigir distorções que privilegiam os muito ricos, como também para que o país se insira em melhores condições na nova economia. Sem mais delongas, vamos saudar o professor da Universidade de Colômbia e Prêmio Nobel de Economia de 2001, Joseph Stiglitz.
Joseph Eugene Stiglitz nasceu em fevereiro de 1943 na cidade de Gary, Indiana, nos Estados Unidos. Se formou em economia em 1964 no Amherst College e fez o doutorado no Massachusetts Institute of Technology, o MIT. Lecionou em renomadas universidades como Yale, Harvard e Stanford. E desde o início dos anos 2000 é professor de Economia, Administração de Empresas e Negócios Internacionais na Universidade de Colômbia, em Nova York. Além do Nobel que recebeu em 2001, foi eleito uma das pessoas mais influentes do mundo pela revista Time em 2011.
Para entrevistar o professor Joseph Stiglitz, nós convidamos Alex Ribeiro, repórter especial do Valor Econômico, Jefferson Nascimento, coordenador de Justiça Social e Econômica da Oxfam Brasil, Laura Carpusca, economista, professora do INSPER, Vilma da Conceição Pinto, economista, diretora da IFE, a Instituição Fiscal Independente, e Vinícius Torres Freire, colunista e editorialista da Folha de São Paulo. A tradução simultânea está a cargo de Leslie Cohen e os desenhos em tempo real são do nosso Luciano Veronese. Boa noite, professor. Obrigada por estar aqui com a gente hoje. Em março, o senhor, quando esteve no Brasil, a convite do BNDES para um debate sobre juros, o senhor defendeu que o presidente Lula estava correto na sua cruzada pela queda das taxas básicas dos juros no Brasil. Essa queda começou, porém, num ritmo moderado, paulatino. O senhor acha que haveria espaço para o Brasil intensificar essa redução da taxa de juros em busca de um maior crescimento, em busca de taxas aí mais robustas de crescimento do PIB?
Very much so. Your interest rates are still significantly higher than the rest of the world. The real interest rate adjusted for inflation. And that discourages investment. And investment is particularly important at this moment for two reasons. One, Brazil has to make the ecological transformation to the green economy, mm-hmm. and that is going to require lots of investment. But you can't do that investment when your interest rate is very high. And secondly, there's a risk of a significant global slowdown. Most forecasters are expecting a global slowdown. partly caused by the increase in the interest rate in the Federal Reserve that spread around the world. Mm-hmm. And if the global markets are weakening, it's really important for Brazil to strengthen its markets, and that Brazil is one of the few countries that has room to do that because its interest rates before the pandemic were so high.
Perfeito. Laura, por favor.
Eu vou fazer uma pergunta que não é de conjuntura econômica. Eu queria pedir para você, Joseph, definir um modelo econômico em vigor no mundo hoje. Como é que você definiria um capitalismo oligopolístico? E mais, na verdade, interessado em saber a definição, eu queria saber qual que você acha que é a relação desse modelo econômico com o status das nossas democracias no mundo hoje.
So, I think the model that people talked about was a very competitive economy where competition ensured efficiency and everybody would benefit. That was the way it was described by Friedman, Hayek, lots of people. But when you see the market economy of 2023, what you see is something very different. What you see, what some people describe as a rent-seeking economy, which means you look for whatever profits you can get. It's not competitive. Warren Buffett, one of the wealthiest successful American investors, emphasized how important it was for success to build walls, to become a monopolist. And Bill Gates makes some money by innovation, but most of his money came by creating a monopoly. And he was, you know, Microsoft was convicted of, was accused and convicted of being anti-competitive in US and Europe and in Asia. But these are just examples, and it's an exploitive economy. To give you some more examples, we have companies like the makers of the opioids, yes, that created the opioid addiction that led to so great that the life expectancy in the United States has plummeted. We have food manufacturers that created a childhood diabetes crisis in the United States. And we had the financial companies that created the 2008 financial crisis. So we have to recognize that we don't have that competitive ideal that's in the textbook that everybody who studies economics reads about. It's a very different kind of economy. So to me, one of the agenda going forward is how do you bring this under, make the economy more competitive, make it more responsive to the necessity of the green transition, stop the exploitation that has been a lot of the basis of the market economy. I think we can do it, but it's going to take a larger role for government. And we've seen why we need government. Pandemic, just think of where we would have been without government efforts to create the vaccine and distribute it. Wasn't done perfectly, but the government, without the government, it would not have been done at all. And we would all be suffering from the pandemic. That's just one instance where everybody now recognizes that government has to have an important role. So we have to get more balance in our economy. I call it progressive capitalism. Mm-hmm. Some people call it a social democracy. Now, that comes to the second part of your question. I think the failures of this unfettered capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, the fact that those in the bottom and even those in the middle have not shared in the prosperity has given rise, not surprisingly, to a lot of anger. And that has fed the kind of populism that is putting us on the road to fascism. And that's been a real worry. I wrote about this in my book, The Price of Inequality, and I said one of the worries I have is that we are providing a fertile field for a populist that will lead us, a demagogue. And unfortunately, I was too right. And it's not just in the United States. You have Bolsonaro here. There are lots of examples of these populists growing up. It's not the only reason. I don't want to say inequality is the only reason, but it created a fertile field.
Certo. Alex.
Queria voltar um pouquinho ao assunto juros muito altos aqui no Brasil. Quando a gente conversa com o Banco Central, ele diz, as autoridades dizem, olha, a gente também tem o desejo de baixar a taxa de juros, que é muito alta, mas o Brasil tem um histórico complicado com inflação muito alta. Nos anos 80, a gente teve uma década perdida com a inflação muito alta, tivemos uma recessão há 10 anos para poder combater essa inflação muito alta. O argumento deles, olha, a inflação aí está alta, a gente tem uma meta de 3%, temos que manter esse juro alto para baixar essa inflação. Se baixar um juro sem cuidado, a gente não vai descuidar da inflação e voltar ao velho problema?
The current inflation is different from normal inflation. And you've had inflation. I understand Brazil's concern about inflation. Perfectly normal. But this inflation, the post-pandemic inflation, is different from the inflation that Brazil and the world has had in the past. This is mostly a supply-side inflation. The pandemic gave rise to very large shifts in demand that also contributed to the inflation. But it's not an excess of aggregate demand. The interest rate is a very blunt instrument, and it works on aggregate demand. And unfortunately, in this case, often high interest rates are counterproductive. They actually worsen the situation. Let me give you some example. So, and I'm going to talk about the United States because I know the data for the United States much better than I do the Brazilian data. But a major source of inflation in the United States is housing. If you looked at the aggregate statistics, you'd say we should have housing prices coming down. Why? Under Trump, we killed off more than 1 million Americans. When you have fewer people, demand for housing should go down. And if demand goes down, the prices should go down. What happened? The pandemic meant that people living in New York was less interesting. You couldn't leave your apartment. So people wanted to go to Southampton and to Hudson Valley, various places outside. You can't overnight increase the supply of housing. The price went up there. But in New York, the price came down, but very, very little. And the average, therefore, went up. But if you have a supply problem, like in the Hudson Valley, what do you want to do? You want to build more housing. What does raising interest rates do? Make it more difficult. So they exacerbate the problem. Let me give you another example of where the source of inflation. Chips, automobiles. In the beginning of the inflation, you could see in the data, about a third of the inflation was due to automobiles. America, we knew how to produce cars. We still knew. We had our factories. What was the problem? The problem is that car companies forgot to order chips, and the chip manufacturers shifted their production elsewhere. Well, when the demand came back, the car companies put in orders. The chip company said it's going to take us a long while. There were some other problems in the chip industry. But it was only a matter of time before the chip started coming. Was it high interest rates that led to more chip production? No. It was just time. And then car production came back, inventories built up, and car prices came down. You take the war in Ukraine, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that got oil prices up, fertilizer prices, which affected Brazil, up. Does raising interest rates solve the problem of shortage of oil? No. So the basic fact is that today's inflation is not caused by an excess of aggregate demand.
Sad.
And so as what I predicted was that as we market responded to the problems, prices would come down, and they have come down. I mean, not prices, but inflation rates would come down. So in the United States, we've almost achieved the 3-4% inflation. And I think, you know, Brazil is doing very well, not because, let me make it clear, not because of the high interest rates of the central bank. It's doing well in spite of the high interest rates of the central bank. And inflation is coming down not because of the high interest rates. It's coming down because markets are finally responding. Same. There's one more element I want to raise, which is related to Laura's question. One of the things that happened in the post-pandemic period was there were these supply shortages, and a lot of firms had even more market power than they do normally. We saw the market power be going up for years. Then all of a sudden, it went way up. Mm-hmm. And they saw that if they raised the prices, nobody could come in and compete because the supply chains were broken. And I'm hopeful now that that market power will be reduced as supply linkages regain. But it's very important to strengthen competition policy. And that goes back again to Laura's thing. If we got more competition, markups would go down.
Professor, eu queria fazer uma pergunta focada um pouco no contexto da sua resposta dada tanto a Vera quanto a Laura, relacionado à questão da agenda climática. O senhor enfatizou em ambas as respostas a questão da agenda climática e a gente está passando e tem discutido isso de forma muito intensa nos últimos anos. E a minha pergunta é se a velocidade com que os países estão respondendo a isso é adequada e se a direção também está adequada. E qual é a visão do senhor em relação a essa agenda? Essa é a principal agenda, a questão global, econômica, ou a gente tem outras questões a serem enfrentadas na mesma proporção de importância?
Well, let me say, I think it is key agenda. It's what we would say is existential. You know, if we burn up, nothing else matters. So if we don't solve the climate change problem, it's going to be a real problem. You know, some conservatives talk about debt and the legacy of debt that we're leaving to our children. If we leave a planet that is not, in which we've ruined the planet that we live, we can't go to any other planet. If we have debt, we know how to restructure debt. We don't know how to solve to go to another planet. So we have to live within our planetary boundaries. And, you know, once we started modernization, the Industrial Revolution, we didn't know about the planetary boundaries then. And we started putting carbon into the atmosphere, more and more carbon. We didn't know the effects. But it was really interesting, an achievement of modern science. More than 100 years ago, a physicist, chemist said that if you put these carbon in the atmosphere, it would lead to global warming. And his predictions were correct. It's a real achievement of science. You make a prediction on the basis of theory, and then you see that the effects are real. And unfortunately, in the last few years, we are really seeing the effects. So you ask, are they adequate? No, what we're doing is not adequate. There's an urgency here. You know, we've been, there's an old expression of Nero fiddling while Rome burned. I feel like we're fiddling, and the world is burning. And we see, it's not only a metaphor, the world is burning. We have wildfires everywhere. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's a first order of business. But I believe if we do it right, it can stimulate economic growth. I think what you did under Bolsonaro to the Amazon was not only bad for climate in the world, it was bad for climate in Brazil. And because evaporation from the Amazon affects rainfall in the rest of Brazil. Mm-hmm. So doing something about climate is good for Brazil, it's good for the globe. And one can design policies that respond to climate change that actually promote economic growth. In some ways, some of the things that you did early on here in Brazil, the development of biofuels was on this agenda before it became more fashionable. But you sort of lost the momentum in the last few years. And now, what I'm very excited about is President Lula is regaining and pushing the momentum. And it's really exciting to have Brazil going along this. Now, you asked, are there other items that need to be on the agenda? Yes, I think there are. I mean, obviously, inequality. But I see all of these as complementary. A bad environment affects the poorest countries and affects the poorest people in each country. So if we don't do something about the environment, including climate change, it will worsen inequality. And in the same way, the pandemic both exposed and exacerbated our inequalities. So it's really important to, if you're concerned about the inequality agenda, to do something about the environmental agenda. But I think we have to do more than that. I always keep coming back to the United States because naturally it's a country I know best. One of the reasons that so many people I referred to, you know, more than a million people died in the United States was that we had a very poor health system.
Perfect.
You would think as a rich country, we would have good health, but we have among the advanced countries, the lowest level of life expectancy and the highest level of disparities in life expectancies. Now, one of the countries that we had more deaths than, say, Brazil, but per capita, you did better. You had more deaths. And that was because you, too, don't have an adequate public health care. You paid insufficient attention to some really big inequalities in your country. You have more inequalities. And so I think it's even more important that Brazil address these issues of inequality.
Perfeito. Com isso, então, a gente fecha o nosso primeiro bloco do Roda Viva, vai para um breve intervalo, volta já com as perguntas do Jefferson Nascimento e do Vinícius Torres Freire. Não sai daí. Estamos de volta com o Roda Viva e quem pergunta agora para o professor Joseph Stiglitz é o Jefferson Nascimento.
Professor, dando sequência à série de perguntas iniciada pela Vilma a respeito de grandes temas, eu gostaria de ir para a pauta das desigualdades. O senhor já mencionou um pouco alguns temas agora, especificamente sobre a temática da tributação. Onde a gente olha para o mundo hoje, a gente vê debates sobre reformas tributárias, com esse viés progressivo, né, de aumento de tributação sobre os muito ricos. Aqui na América Latina, por exemplo, a gente teve recentemente a Colômbia aprovando uma reforma tributária, há debate similar, por exemplo, no Chile, né, no Congresso, e agora também no Brasil. Pegando uma frase que, foi, que se atribui a Victor Hugo, né, nada é mais poderoso do que uma ideia que chega no tempo certo. esse é o caso da tributação das pessoas muito ricas?
Very much so. One way of putting it is that Brazil and many of these other countries have a tax system that's not fair. That the rich pay a smaller percentage of their income than the poor. And so it's not saying tax the rich at a higher rate. It's just restoring fairness to have them taxed at least at the same rate. And President Lula's proposed reforms are only trying to close some of the terrible loopholes and exemptions that actually simultaneously distort the economy. So I believe for several reasons that these tax reforms are not only fairer, create a more just society, but are actually good for the economy, really good for the economy, both macroeconomically and microeconomically.
Professor, ainda sobre tributação, especialmente aqui no Brasil, se difundiu um slogan: tributem as grandes fortunas, o patrimônio, os ativos. Agora, existem problemas para se tributar práticos, né? Problemas práticos para se tributar patrimônio, fortuna, ativos, que são empresas, imóveis, ativos financeiros. A minha pergunta é, não seria melhor fazer uma tributação mais eficaz sobre grandes rendas em vez de tentar outra vez tributar ativos, patrimônio? A experiência na Europa e mesmo nos Estados Unidos do pós-guerra é que a tributação sobre grandes rendas funcionou melhor do que a tributação sobre grandes fortunas, grandes patrimônios. E um grande patrimônio é o resultado do fluxo de grandes rendas. Então, em termos práticos, para uma política pública de tributação melhor, o senhor é a favor de uma tributação de renda ou de patrimônio?
I think you should do both. And
quanto de cada?
That would depend on the circumstances of the country, and I can't give you a precise answer to that. But we know, for instance, Argentina has a low tax on wealth, not the income of wealth, but wealth, and it generates significant tax revenue. You know, I jokingly say that one of the advantages of Argentina and Brazil have is they have so much inequality that just taxing a very low tax rate on the very wealthy generates a lot of income. The advantage of a low tax rate is that it limits the amount of response that they have. It's not worth deciding to live in Uruguay or someplace else to protect your assets. So it turns out that there are some advantages of both wealth taxes and income taxes. But what is really important for Brazil is to close the current loopholes. Much of this, we have the same debate in the United States. We have a huge loophole in our taxation of capital income. And people like Elizabeth Warren have proposed a tax on wealth, only at the very, very top. So you're affecting, less than 1% of the population. But a tax on that very top, less than 1% of the population, generates, even in America, a lot of revenue.
Professor, eu queria falar um pouquinho com o senhor sobre déficit. Nosso ministro da Economia, da Fazenda, Fernando Haddad, lançou um novo marco fiscal brasileiro que propõe zerar o déficit primário já no ano que vem. Isso foi considerado muito ambicioso por alguns e necessita forçosamente que se aumente a arrecadação de forma a garantir esse déficit zero. Tem uma teoria que ganha força no mundo, segundo a qual o déficit seria um mito, ele não seria assim tão ruim governos produzirem déficits. Queria saber se o senhor partilha dessa opinião e se o senhor acha que o ministro está errado em insistir em zerar o nosso déficit já no ano que vem.
Well, the basic framework view, I think, is that the financial markets have paid too much attention to the deficit GDP ratio, but you can't ignore it. So I think where the government is probably in the right area. But let me try to explain. There are two ways of reducing the deficit GDP ratio. One of them is to impose austerity, affect the numerator, and the second is to grow the economy and make the denominator bigger. And it's what you give priority to that's really important. So if you give priority to austerity, what happens everywhere, is the economy slows down, the denominator gets smaller, GDP goes down, and the debt GDP ratio often even goes up. So you don't solve the problem. But if you have a focus yourself on growth policies, then you can get the GDP up and the deficit GDP ratio can go down. So you have to be very careful if you are reducing the numerator not to cause the denominator to go down. And that's where the finance minister's policies really work, because they're focusing on taxing the people at the very top. And we know that those have the least adverse effect on growth. And if you take some of that revenue and you put it into growth policies, you can offset the negative effects that have come from the fiscal consolidation. So to me, the view that of the financial markets that the deficit is the only thing to focus on, that's wrong. Austerity never works. And the growth policies are really the ones that you ought to focus on.
Professor, sobre déficit fiscal. No Brasil, a gente, nós temos um déficit primário faz quase 10 anos. A dívida pública, a relação dívida PIB está crescendo sem parar. O aumento do gasto público e do déficit não resultou em aumento de investimentos, ao contrário. A maior parte do nosso gasto é previdência, pensions, salários, benefícios sociais, saúde e educação. Nós não temos uma política de crescimento, a gente não descobriu uma política de crescimento para aumentar o denominador. Então, o que tem acontecido frequentemente em ciclos é que um aumento de endividamento ou de déficit tem provocado o aumento das taxas de juros de longo prazo, desvalorizações cambiais e aí um pouco mais de inflação e um pouco mais de necessidade de aumento de taxa básica de juros. Então, nós temos um problema circular e nós não aumentamos a nossa taxa de investimento, os nossos ativos, com o aumento da dívida e do déficit, nem temos uma política outra de crescimento. Então, o senhor acha que aumentar o gasto ainda mais vai provocar um crescimento suficiente para compensar o aumento da dívida? No nosso caso brasileiro, nós temos experiências muito ruins e muito evidentes de que isso não aconteceu.
Yeah, I understand your history, but history is not necessarily have to repeat itself. So, first of all, Brazil net debt debt to GDP ratio is actually
58%.
Yeah, is low relative to most other countries. We're 100. So you don't need to be as excited about it as other countries do. You're lucky. You've had periods of fiscal consolidation that worked, and you're in a better position right now. Secondly, as I look at my conversations with various people in President Lula's government, they are working on a growth policy. They're talking about technological innovation. They're talking about the ecological transition, which would be a technological revolution. So I'm actually optimistic, and they're very focused on promoting investment. Domestic investment as well as foreign investment. You know, one of the problems is you often get foreign companies to come in. That's good. But I think it would be a lot better to promote more domestic entrepreneurs. I know you have a lot of good entrepreneurship. One of the problems in promoting domestic entrepreneurship is the high interest rate, to come back to the issue we've talked about many times. But you're not going to have a vibrant entrepreneurial class if they have to borrow at the highest interest rates in the world.
Joseph. Alex.
Professor, voltando ao tema da taxação dos mais ricos, há muito tempo se tenta taxar os mais ricos aqui no Brasil. Quer dizer, se alguém tem muito dinheiro, coloca dinheiro num fundo de investimento, essa pessoa não paga imposto. E se você for classe média, você paga o imposto investido nesse fundo de investimento. Um dos argumentos contra a taxação é que ele vai provocar uma erosão da base de arrecadação. O dinheiro vai sair do Brasil e você não vai conseguir taxar. É verdadeiro esse argumento?
Não. They told me I should have short answers. but let me elaborate just a little bit. Of course you expect wealthy people to say that. You know, of course you expect, it's in their self-interest to say, don't tax me, because if you tax me, everybody will suffer. I've seen it in the United States, the financial market says, don't regulate us, because if you regulate us, we won't be able to lend well. And we saw what happens when you didn't regulate the banks. We had a global financial crisis. So the evidence is overwhelming that having a fairer system of taxes will promote growth. They're still going to save. And what you really need is to promote Brazilian investment. And the most important thing for doing that is doing something about the high interest rates in the financial markets and expanding development banks like BNDES.
Certo, Laura?
Joseph, o Solow nos disse que a gente cresce porque a gente poupa. Cass Koopman nos disse que a gente poupa porque a gente prefere poupar. Barron nos disse que a gente cresce se a gente inova. E o Acemoglu nos disse que a gente cresce se a gente tem instituições que permitam o crescimento. E o Joseph Stiglitz, qual que ele acha que é a causa fundamental do desenvolvimento econômico?
Oh. Economic development, we know a lot of things that stop economic development. If you don't save, it's very hard to grow. If you have bad institutions, if you don't have reasonable trust in government, rules of law, mm-hmm. you don't grow. If you don't have entrepreneurship and innovation, you don't grow. But in your list, I would also say, if you don't have good government and trust in government, government, I mentioned, is very important in innovation in universities. Why is America one of the strongest economies? Why is Silicon Valley where Silicon Valley is? Silicon Valley is where Silicon Valley is because of Stanford and Berkeley. Why are Stanford and Berkeley so strong? Because they've received a lot of grants on research from the federal government. Mm-hmm. And none of these institutions are for-profit institutions. They're either foundations or state, like University of California at Berkeley. Yes. So you need to have a balance of institutions. To me, achieving that kind of balance is difficult. Most countries have not achieved it. There's been a lot of learning. For emerging markets, the best example is what happened in East Asia. Mm-hmm. We call it I wrote a book called, you know, the East Asia Miracle, when I worked with the World Bank on this. The question was, what led to success? And an important part of it was this mixture that I described. We also talked about the importance of promoting equality, more equal societies grow better. Now that's wisdom of the IMF and the OECD. And an important thing that's finally coming back in the policy discourse is industrial policy. The role of the government in promoting innovation, promoting structural transformation. And it couldn't be more important now than now because of the green transition. The United States, for 40 years, told countries not to have industrial policies. Until this year, it had the most massive industrial policy of its own that any country has ever had. So industrial policy is back. And I think that's a great thing for countries like Brazil.
Certo. Jefferson, depois Vilma.
Ficando nos grandes temas, falando sobre desigualdade e democracia. No seu livro Povo, Poder e Lucro, o senhor menciona essa ideia de que as democracias e a democracia e a economia, ela tem sido uma democracia e uma economia nos Estados Unidos e no mundo. Do 1% para 1% e pelo 1%. Né? Essa concentração... dominando todo o debate econômico e a democracia e o risco que isso ocasiona, que a gente tem visto ao redor do mundo, de opções autoritárias nesse contexto permeado também pela austeridade, com a população não conseguindo ter acesso a direitos, acesso a políticas públicas e se voltando contra, de alguma maneira, o estabelecimento político e indo para opções autoritárias. Os Estados Unidos passou por isso. O Brasil passou por esse movimento também. Então, eu gostaria de perguntar para o senhor, o Brasil sendo desses países que passou por essa experiência, qual é o papel do Brasil nesse contexto? Né? A gente tem algumas, no caso da América Latina, por exemplo, o caso do El Salvador, de um caso de uma opção autoritária muito popular. Qual é o papel do Brasil nesse contexto, desse debate sobre democracia e desigualdades?
Well, I think I worry that you might say fascism, populism, is like a contagious disease, and we saw how President Trump normalized bad behavior. Bolsonaro did the same thing within Latin America, and this normalization, breaking norms, going against truth, attacking. Basic institutions like the media is disastrous for our society. And so Brazil, as the most important country in the Southern Hemisphere, important in size, in the role, in every dimension, has a very important role to play as an example. Now that you've recuperated your democracy with a vibrant, civil society, academia, press, hopefully, you and Indonesia have a really important role to play in showing that among emerging markets, developing countries, democracy can work.
Certo, Vilma.
Eu gostaria de introduzir um outro assunto na nossa discussão, relacionado aos desafios da revolução tecnológica e da automação. Como que o senhor enxerga esses temas no contexto de desigualdade e no contexto de desafios globais? Também, se puder associar isso um pouco à questão das discussões referentes a sistemas tributários, seria interessante.
Okay, so first, I'm very worried. That as bad as inequality is today, it could get worse. That the innovations that are occurring are likely to exacerbate our inequalities. You know, some people say, don't worry, look, we had innovations at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. The buggy whip we no longer needed, but we had car repairs. But the new innovations are focused on doing routine jobs And AI can even do learning. So the new innovations are going to be particularly harsh on workers. So it's going to reduce the demand, and either there'll be unemployment or wages will go down, unless government intervenes in one way or another. And there are a number of ways that government can intervene. For instance, I think more R&D should be directed at saving the planet than creating more unemployment by reducing the demand for unskilled labor. So government can play a bigger role in steering innovation in ways that really address our social needs. Silicon Valley disproportionately is nothing more than research to make a better advertising system.
Professor, o senhor acabou de falar que existe a possibilidade de que os governos façam políticas públicas que aproveitem a inovação e, ao mesmo tempo, evitem que as pessoas fiquem desempregadas. O professor Daron Acemoğlu diz a mesma coisa, tem escrito sobre isso. Não tem sido muito prático e específico, mas ele diz que teoricamente é possível, ele tem escrito muito isso. Eu gostaria de saber que tipo de política é possível, em linhas gerais, para fazer com que se aproveite a automação que se associe à mão de obra e não a automação que expulse a mão de obra. Eu tenho dificuldade de ver como isso é possível. Eu gostaria muito que o senhor tivesse uma resposta, mas eu ainda não vi respostas muito específicas sobre isso. Como é que isso é possível? Ou a senhora acha que a gente vai acabar num regime que muitas pessoas vão ter sobreviver com uma renda mínima?
So, the first thing is that when you look at the structure of our taxation, we impose high costs on labor in most countries. In the United States, which leads the innovation, we impose Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes, and that raises the cost of labor, and that means there's a private incentive to reduce the cost of labor, and reducing the cost of labor means the kind of innovation. And it's even worse in the United States. We're not talking about Brazil here, but in the United States, which is the center of innovation, we've had the cost of capital at zero. So we've distorted the innovation system to say, don't save on capital, because that's very cheap, save on labor. And meanwhile, we charge nothing for the environment. So no incentive to preserve the environment. So somebody who believes partly in the market incentives do matter. We distorted market incentives in ways that have steered innovation to create more unemployment or lower wages. We ought to steer it. We know how to steer it the other way. Also, government, the structure of government basic research. Remember, government really finances an important part of research. Mm-hmm. It should be investing more in research to save our planet, and it is doing that, than in creating more unemployment.
Com isso, então, a gente fecha o nosso segundo bloco do Roda Viva com o Nobel de Economia Joseph Stiglitz. Vai para um breve intervalo e volta já já. De volta com o Roda Viva, que hoje recebe o Prêmio Nobel de Economia e professor de Colômbia, Joseph Stiglitz. Professor, o senhor já falou um pouco de reindustrialização, de nova política industrial, mas em países como o Brasil, que por muitos anos abdicaram desse tipo de política e simplesmente ingressaram na globalização que traz tudo de fora e quebra aí, qualquer cadeia local de produção. A gente já não começa muito atrás em termos de inovação e pesquisa nessa corrida? Como fazer para encurtar um pouco esse caminho? A gente deveria apostar em alguns setores específicos que poderiam gerar um ganho para o Brasil?
you should remember that you have had some amazing successes. Every time I go on an airplane in Europe, or I get on an Embraer airplane, and I mentioned before the success that you had in the early biofuel that's still with us. So I think Brazil, because of your technological capacities, can recuperate. It's not just a matter of catching up. I would put it leapfrogging and taking advantage of some of your natural comparative advantages in the Amazon, your biodiversity, the agriculture. But the issue is, how do you move up the value chain? You have these resources. How do you make sure that these resources are accrue more to the benefit of Brazil? One of the fundamental problems historically is that the advanced countries wanted countries like Brazil and those in Africa to stay at the primary stage of production. Just export iron ore, don't export products. And I think we're at a stage now where emerging markets like Brazil should take a more active policy and insist on having more of the development process, the value added, occur within the country. Indonesia has done that with its nickel. It said no export of nickel. You have to do some value added, and we'll judge how much you need to do if you want to get access to our nickel.
Perfeito, Laura.
Eu queria falar de informação. A gente está vivendo uma revolução informacional com as redes sociais, né? A forma como a gente consome e gera informação mudou muito. E eu queria saber se você tem alguma preocupação com isso, né? Alguns economistas se preocupam desde as redes sociais e a forma como elas impactam o nosso consumo de informação, poder impactar eficiências de mercado, a própria democracia. E se você acha que os economistas eles estão ajudando ou piorando o debate relacionado a isso?
Well, let me first say that I think it's a real problem that the information ecosystem has become polluted and with a lot of bad information. Now, the real difficulty that we who believe in rights and democracy have is that we also want to maintain an active press and free speech, but we've never had complete free speech. You can't libel somebody. You can't cry fire in a crowded theater. Child pornography. We know that we have to regulate, and we have principles that guide that. And we're always doing a balance: social welfare and the harms versus the dangers. And we try to create institutions to make sure there are not abuses on either side, both on the regulation and on the unfettered speech. So we're in a new world here, though, that the social media have exacerbated problems of virality, the spread of bad stories rapidly. I can't tell you how many conspiracy theories go around the United States, everywhere. They affect our elections deliberately. So I think we have to work hard to create a new framework. Europe is trying. They have something called the Digital Service Act. Brazil has done a lot of work in this area. The United States, not surprisingly, lags behind, because we have financial interests that don't want that regulation. You know, a few years ago, they said self-regulation. And I said, well, self-regulation reminds me of what happened with banking. And 5 years on, everybody agrees self-regulation is not working. Do we want the control of the major bulletin board of the world in the hands of Elon Musk? And the general consensus is no. So I think we have to think more creatively about how to restore a good information ecosystem. The government will play a role. And I think when you said, what role do economists play, I would say some economists misunderstand principles of market economics and say, leave it to the market. Market works good in some areas, but in the area of information, it works particularly bad. That was the subject of my Nobel Prize. Yes.
Professor,
o senhor defendeu aqui a política industrial, o papel dos bancos públicos para prover crédito para segmentos da sociedade, para poder fazer esses investimentos. Isso foi uma coisa que o Brasil tentou há 10 anos. O BNDES expandiu muito a sua atividade e a taxa de investimento no Brasil não reagiu, ficou parada, cresceu muito pouco. Muita gente disse que a alocação de capital pelos bancos públicos é ineficiente, escolheu os setores errados, os campeões nacionais, e que essa estratégia não deu certo. Por que que a gente poderia teria que voltar a uma coisa que já não funcionou no passado?
Well, actually, I think the BNDES did succeed. Now, let me say, no human institution is perfect. Human fallibility is unfortunately, I say everybody else that I know, everybody besides me I know is fallible. So why should we expect, given the fallibility of individuals, why should we expect human institutions to be other than fallible? But they make some good investment. They supported, and I think the Embraer, I referred to that, one of your big industries. And out of that grew a lot of smaller firms that are doing special parts, and it had some multiplier effects. I think by studying the successes around the world, and there have been a lot of successes, one can lead to higher economic growth. Moreover, what we discovered in the post-pandemic world, and this is related to some of our earlier discussion, is that markets were insufficiently resilient. And so it's not only a matter of growth that we need government, BNDES and other kinds, but we also need it to promote resilience. Do you want to be totally dependent on Taiwan for your chips?
Já prometido para Vilma. Vilma, tá. Por favor.
Professor, eu gostaria de trazer um pouco para o contexto mais de conjuntural. E como que o senhor está avaliando a questão da economia global diante de pressões que a gente e tensões comerciais que a gente tem observado entre os Estados Unidos, a China, e como que isso pode, de certa forma, impactar o Brasil?
That is a major issue for the global economy. The Democrats and the Republicans in the United States are at war over everything except one issue, and that's China. And China's the bad guy. So this is going to be a constant of U.S. policy, and that's going to have spillover effects on the rest of the world. In many areas, Brazil is very dependent on China. Some commodities, 80% of the exports go to China. I think every country in the world needs at this point to frame the issue as one of de-risking, of recognizing that we don't know where things are going. China has said that, many people in China say, we are going to retake Taiwan one way or the other in the next 5 years. I don't know whether it's going to occur, but if it does, it is a risk. And that's related to my previous answer. Do you want to be so dependent on Taiwan risks, chips, and on other trade with China? But this is really, going back to industrial policy, this is really an opportunity to have more value added created here in Brazil.
Professor, em 2021, o senhor, junto com outros economistas e lideranças, assinou uma carta solicitando a suspensão da propriedade intelectual de vacinas para a dirigida ao governo Biden, dentro daquele contexto ainda inicial da vacinação da Covid. Inclusive, o senhor depois escreveu um artigo também avaliando um pouco o processo aqui no Brasil de licenciamento compulsório aprovado por lei, que ainda não foi regulamentado. Um ano e meio depois desse período e vendo todos os efeitos da desigualdade no acesso à vacina de Covid no planeta, qual a avaliação que o senhor faz desse processo, né, e a avaliação que faz desse mecanismo de proteção via patente de vacinas?
The system that we have of intellectual property worked disastrously in the pandemic. Now, we have in the system a provision for compulsory licenses in the context of an epidemic or a pandemic. But the drug companies have subverted that, because what they've done has said, made it a legal nightmare. And to get that compulsory license will take a long time. In a pandemic, in COVID-19, we couldn't wait. It was spreading like wildfire everywhere. So South Africa and India said, we have to suspend intellectual property rights. You give fair compensation royalties to those who have them. So it's not, you get compensated, but not a monopoly. And anybody who could produce the vaccine or the therapeutic anywhere in the world could do it, because there's a supply shortage. India had a lot of capacity. Brazil almost surely would have a capacity to produce these kinds of vaccines. But the drug companies said, no, we put our profits over the lives of people. And so I, with a lot of Nobel Prize winners and a lot of leaders, wrote a letter to President Biden and said, this is unconscionable. You have to do something. And we persuaded him to support this waiver of intellectual property rights. But unfortunately, the drug companies were more powerful in Germany and Switzerland, UK, and they blocked it. And they showing how the system, our international system, wasn't working. And intellectual property is supposed to promote innovation, but most of that was paid for by government. And most of the work was done by government and universities. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that the drug companies just took their profits. There was what we call vaccine apartheid, where every American could get as many vaccines as he wanted, and most of the rest of the world had no access to vaccines.
Perfeito. Com isso, então, a gente fecha o nosso terceiro bloco do Roda Viva, vai para mais uma rápida interrupção e volta já já com mais Joseph Stiglitz. Estamos de volta e quem vai perguntar agora para o professor Joseph Stiglitz é o Vinícius Torres Freire.
Professor, imagine que o senhor estivesse entediado em Colômbia e resolvesse se tornar assessor do governo da Argentina. Não sei se o senhor conhece muito o governo da Argentina, mas os problemas econômicos maiores são muito evidentes. A Argentina ou não tem moeda ou tem várias. Está com um processo de superinflação, não tem o mercado de financiamento doméstico da dívida, não tem reservas internacionais, o Banco Central financia o governo, em parte. Como começar, como poderia ser possível começar um processo de reforma da Argentina? Lembre-se, o senhor é o grande consultor do governo da Argentina, tem que ser uma medida, três medidas práticas imediatas.
Let me say first, it's hard. It's a challenge. So, secondly, it was actually doing pretty well until the current finance minister took over. If you look at the inflation rate in Argentina, in spite of all the problems they had, the drought, inherited $44 billion.
Mas a inflação está subindo desde 2017, muito.
But they had the drought, they had the They had the pandemic, and then they had inherited debt of $44 billion. Under the finance minister, Guzman, they were able to start their economy growing 10% in 1 year, and inflation remained stable. And it's an amazing chart. It was looks like this until the current finance minister took over, and it went like this. So the point is that bad policy really makes things worse. Good policy doesn't get rid of the debt, doesn't solve all the problems, but is a move in the right direction. It's going to take a long time. So the first thing I would say is reverse the current policies of the government in the last several months, including with the policy they just abolished income taxes in a country with a lot of inequality and desperately need of revenue. It was mind-boggling.
Professor, trazendo a discussão de volta para os Estados Unidos, o seu país. O senhor mesmo disse, o governo Biden lançou uma injeção de recursos na economia para tentar induzir o crescimento inédita nas últimas décadas nos Estados Unidos. É, a economia está reagindo, está crescendo, apesar dos juros altos, mas ainda assim o presidente não é favorito para sua reeleição. E Donald Trump, que fez o que fez com a democracia, ainda pode ser candidato e tem uma chance de ser eleito. O que está errado entre economia e política nos Estados Unidos?
Well, part of it is communication is really important, as you would know, mm-hmm. you're in that business. And I think they've obviously not succeeded in communicating their successes, which have been enormous. Infrastructure bill, a CHIPS and Science Act, a Green Investment Technology Act, provisions that bring down the price of medicines. You know, I could go on. It's a real list of successes, probably one of the most successful presidencies in a very long time. But, as you said, the Republicans have succeeded in characterizing him as old, not able to do things. You don't, you know, in spite of his accomplishments being the great, most significant accomplishments, age is not, you know, he did it. And he's played a vital role in those successes. So it's a mystery to me. A little bit, to be honest. And I'm actually more optimistic than those polls that when people start getting closer to the elections and they ask the question, do they want another 4 years of the chaos, of the lies, of the, you know, of the dismantling of our democracy, of the discrediting of U.S. in foreign eyes, I think they will say, in that privacy of the voting booth, it's too big of a risk to take.
Certo, Alex.
Presidente Lula e outros líderes estão questionando o dólar como a grande moeda de reserva internacional, pregando que se utilize outros tipos de arranjos aí de pagamento, BRICS ou arranjos locais ou uma outra moeda. Concretamente, é viável a gente ter uma outra moeda de reserva, algo que os países emergentes possam usar para competir com o dólar?
Well, I think you have to differentiate the various uses that money has. It's used as transactions, as a store of value, which is like a store of value for ordinary individuals, a store of value for government, which is reserves. In each of those cases, the possibilities are different. So in transactions, in modern technology, the currency doesn't matter very much. It's all electronic. Nobody actually uses paper anymore. During my whole visit here in Brazil, I haven't even gotten any Brazilian currency. It's all So in that way, currency isn't important, but whether I pay in dollars or in real doesn't make any difference to me. The cost of conversion are low. So I think maybe too much emphasis has been placed on it, but symbolically it has a political importance. The U.S. had an has had an advantage as a reserve currency, and you mentioned that in your question. It is possible for other currencies to become a reserve currency. But remember, the yuan, the RMB, is already a reserve currency. While it's true that the BRICS in total is a larger economy than the advanced countries, the question is really the stability and the confidence. And the euro hasn't replaced the dollar, even though it's important. The yen hasn't replaced it. So I think it may play a role, but it won't be at the center other than symbolism.
Laura.
Joseph, você se mostrou preocupado com o grau de monopolização da economia. Por que que você acha que isso aconteceu? Por que que existe um aumento da monopolização na economia? E você destacou muito o papel do governo como inovador, como coordenador na pandemia, mas será que os governos também não colaboraram de alguma forma para o aumento da monopolização nas últimas décadas?
Well, I think there were a number of reasons for the increase in monopoly power. Some of it was that the... Let me begin by saying, without government action, there is a natural tendency of companies to collude. If you create a monopoly, you can raise prices. If you have two firms, why should they compete? It's much better to get together and collude and raise prices. And when I was in the White House, I saw that all the time. Everybody's basic motto was competition is good for everybody else, but not us. And they would tell me why they should not be subjected to competition pressure. So that's a natural state. Government has to come in and make sure that that doesn't happen. And unfortunately, government has not been doing the role that it should as forceful. And the private sector has been very innovative in creating new ways of colluding, some of them very complicated. And the new technologies have provided new mechanisms for them to do this. So there's not been the development in the government sector corresponding to the increase in creativity and collusion that's been the private sector. So the answer is clearly much more forceful government action. Actually, in terms of knowing what to do, I think we actually know what to do right now. Unfortunately, the politics makes it very difficult. Because when I say politics, the politics and the judicial history in the United States, antitrust is largely determined in the courts. The courts follow precedents. The precedents were set in an era of neoliberalism, which said markets are naturally competitive. Now it's very hard to overturn those. We're working at it, and some of them are happening, but it's very, very slow. And getting new legislation is very, very difficult.
Jefferson.
O debate a respeito da transição justa e da agenda climática, tentando trazer um pouco de debate sobre também desigualdades, o Brasil hoje bate recordes de produção de petróleo. Né? A produção de petróleo desde 1980 até agora quase que se multiplicou por 15. E há um debate presente no Brasil hoje a respeito da exploração de petróleo na foz do Rio Amazonas, com críticas da sociedade civil e populações daquela região a respeito do tema. Como conciliar esse debate a respeito também da geração de renda, né, da exploração desse tipo de atividade, e essa agenda ambiental e climática no qual o Brasil se coloca como uma liderança. Como conciliar esses dois elementos?
So, first, I think almost surely it's bad economics. The reason why I say that is very simple. Developing an oil field takes a long time. And then you usually have a full payoff is 20, 30, 40 years. Now remember, we're in 2023, and Europe and the United States say that they will be carbon neutral by 2030, by 2050. And the rest of the world says 2060. I think it will be before that, because the climate change that we're seeing is so devastating that there will be a stronger political movement to go faster. That's 27 years. You won't have the ability to fully reap the value of that, or to put it another way, these will become what we call stranded assets. You make big investments, but you won't be able to get the returns. So I think it's foolish economics. When I balance that with my concern about the environment, remember, destroying the Amazon actually hurts not only the world, but actually hurts Brazil because of what it does to the rainfall in the other parts of the country. And hurting one part of the Amazon hurts other parts of the Amazon. We know that. So we know these complex interactions. So doing something in even one part of the Amazon is bad for Brazil.
Uhum. Com isso, então, a gente fecha o nosso quarto bloco, vai para o último intervalo. Voltamos já já com o encerramento do Roda Viva com Joseph Stiglitz. De volta com o Roda Viva, que hoje é internacional, recebendo o Prêmio Nobel de Economia Joseph Stiglitz. Professor, nós temos recebido aqui no programa muitos pensadores que, como o senhor, relacionam a globalização e os seus efeitos a uma certa quebra do contrato social, com riscos para a democracia. Nós entrevistamos a Minoush Shafiq, da LSE, entrevistamos o professor Michael Sandel há pouco tempo, e todos eles vão nesse sentido, da necessidade de termos um novo contrato social em que os muito ricos aceitem que eles precisam ganhar menos em nome do coletivo. Qual é a receita para a gente conseguir criar, numa sociedade cada vez mais individualista, em que as pessoas estão presas ali no celular e nos seus ganhos, e pensando que elas vão ter de trabalhar muito mais tempo para sobreviver muito mais tempo, porque a longevidade aumentou, como convencer essas pessoas que já estão tão estressadas a compartilhar um certo contrato social?
Well, I think there are two aspects of that. One of them is within the individualistic framework, to make people realize that they will benefit from having a better society. I mentioned before that there's a consensus now among economists that a more equal society performs better economically. Mm-hmm. And who benefits from greater growth more than those at the top? We may not have trickle-down economics, but we have trickle-up economics, so that it would be in their interest to mm-hmm. do so, in their interest in another way. Who likes to live in gated communities behind barbed wires? The dysfunctionality of the populism has to get to even to the rich people. So to me, it is pretty clear that it is in their own self-interest, individualistically, to create a more equal society. But the second thing goes back to the nature of capitalism. Standard economic theory pretends that we're born with fully formed preferences. We're all individualistic, selfish. You know, the basis of modern economics is that individuals are infinitely selfish. Mm-hmm. It's not true. It's not true that they're so selfish that we do care about our fellow citizens, mm-hmm. you care about people in other places. But it's also true that it's not true that we come into the world fully formed. We're shaped. And capitalism, in the form that we had it before, neoliberal capitalism, not only assumed that we were selfish, but made us more selfish. When we said, Gordon Gekko in that famous movie said, greed is good. That became the motto of so many people. Mm-hmm. And so I think as we move to a different kind of society, different kind of more balanced, progressive capitalism is what I call it, we will create people who are less selfish.
Perfeito. Vilma, por favor.
Professor Stiglitz, eu gostaria de fazer uma pergunta, na verdade, pedir uma recomendação do senhor. A gente no Brasil já vive há várias décadas com uma baixa produtividade. Produtividade média do trabalho hoje é cerca de 0,6% nos últimos 40 anos. O que o senhor recomendaria de política econômica, política pública, que pudesse tentar mitigar ou promover um crescimento mais robusto da produtividade no Brasil?
Well, I think exactly the basic of more investment, particularly public investment, in education, health, technology, R&D, infrastructure. You know, these are the bases of the growth of any economy. And I also think a more equal society is more productive. You know, one of the problems is that if you have a lot of inequality, you're wasting the value of your most valuable human resource, your human resources. So it seems to me that both a policy of more equality and a policy of more public investment broadly defined, and then encouraging your financial market rather than just engaged in speculation or consumption to be directed at more investment. All of these would create increased productivity.
Alex.
Professor, nessa sua visita ao Brasil, incluiu uma visita à universidade, e essa é uma geração que vai ter desafios enormes. A gente falou sobre vários desses pontos, desigualdade, mudanças climáticas, risco para a democracia. O que o senhor recomenda para essa geração, essa próxima geração, em termos de preparo e valores para lidar com esse mundo tão mais difícil?
Well, first I'd say they have to get engaged in politics because the decisions that we've talked about are going to be made by political leaders. You know, the worry about the end of democracy, they have the greatest stake. They also have the greatest stake on whether we do anything about climate change. They're going to be around to see it. I'm going to be gone. So the imperative, they need to understand how important being engaged in that is, and I mean politically engaged, but also engaged in trying to think about what kinds of work they might do, and some of it's going to be research, some of it's going to be private sector jobs, but saying, what can I do in the private sector that will promote a better society? Not just profits. I think the two can go hand in hand. You know, the failure of neoliberalism was it put greed over everything else, rather than a better balance. And as they get into whatever job they do, they say, look, I need to, in my firm, to pay attention to green and to the lowest paid workers in our firms.
Professor, a China está com algum grande problema. A gente não sabe o tamanho do problema. No mínimo, eles têm um super investimento em moradias ou infraestrutura, um problema de finanças relacionado a isso também. Faz 20 anos que se diz que a China vai ter um grande rompimento em seu crescimento, vai ser uma grande crise que vai acabar com o seu modelo de crescimento. O senhor acredita que dessa vez, com esse superinvestimento, principalmente em moradias, essa crise financeira relacionada a isso, a China vai ter que mudar profundamente seu modelo para um modelo de mais proteção social, mais consumo, ou o que pode ser feito? Ou essa vai ser uma crise que o governo chinês vai conseguir resolver a sua maneira tradicional? Mais investimento, mais gasto público, etc.
I mean, you're absolutely right. The Western experts have been, pundits have been saying China's about to have a crisis every year, every 2 years, and they've managed their way through it. I've been watching China very, very closely for 40 years. My first visit there was was 43 years ago. So I've been working very strongly with the Chinese government over most of that period. I've never been more worried. It's because the problems are larger and the current government is less equipped to deal with them. And by that I mean the government, current government has purged most of the experts, economic experts that were in earlier governments and has become more authoritarian. And when you are more authoritarian, there's always a risk that you don't listen to the right people. And if his choice of economic experts is right, then they'll get through it. But if they choose the wrong advisors...
É um problema mais político do que financeiro, o senhor acha?
No, I think with the best of economics, it would be very difficult. They've gotten themselves into a very difficult situation. But I think it could be managed through. But I think there is a very high risk that they may not manage their way through this crisis. As I say, the problems are larger, and no country has faced problems exactly like this, so there's no playbook that they can refer to.
Laura?
Joseph, na sua resposta para Vera sobre o novo contrato social, você falou da importância de reduzir desigualdades. Tem uma desigualdade muito importante que é a de representatividade, né? Nem todos nós ocupamos espaços de poder. O que uma pessoa na sua posição pode ajudar a reduzir desigualdades? Talvez, se não no mundo, pelo menos na economia, que é um ambiente bastante masculino e branco.
Well, I think one of the things that academics can do is to expose what is going on. You know, a number of years ago, when Reagan was the president of the United States, was when we first began, you could see the inequality statistics go up. Before that, there was a theory that as you develop, more inequality went down. It was called Kuznick's, and he got a Nobel Prize for it, but then it started to go up, and go up rapidly. So what was Reagan's solution? Let's not have any data, so nobody knows what's happening on. That obviously was not a solution. Academics like us can try to bring out the data, the underrepresentation of, in the United States, African Americans, women, and given the values of our society, that motivates people to do something. Secondly, we have an important role to explain how our system works. And as I've been trying to do, there was a theory about how the system worked, about a competitive economy and how it worked, and everybody benefited, and Pareto optimality, all those kinds of things. But none of them are true of our economy. And it's up to us to show that. And that we have to write the rules of the economy to make it work better. And it's up to us to try to explain what kind of rules will make the economy serve everybody in our society. I think many of the questions we've had today have been, is it possible? I think it's yes. I mean, not perfection, but to work better. It's not been doing well. That's very clear. And so, you know, as academics, I think we have a particular role in exposing and sort of structuring an alternative, showing that there is an alternative. I also think, you know, I have a peculiar position. I'm also an activist. And activism is not for many academics. I think that's fine. You know, what I just described is an important role in our society. But for some people, being more involved in promoting that change, you know, we live in a democracy, and the only way that that change will occur is if people know about it. So it's not only doing the research, but making sure that it's widely known. And that's what those of us who are engaged in activism try to do.
Professor, alguns dias atrás, o senhor, em uma palestra no Supremo Tribunal Federal do Brasil, fez uma fala que acho que sintetizam muito das ideias que são trazidas aqui, que é essa importância de que a economia ela esteja a serviço das pessoas e não o contrário. Eu acredito que essa tenha sido uma ideia que tenha sido compartilhada com muitos dos interlocutores do senhor nessa vinda ao Brasil, tanto interlocutores no governo como na sociedade civil e assim por diante, ou na academia também. Gostaria de saber, nessa avaliação da sua vinda para o Brasil, essa ideia, vendo com a ressonância dessa ideia nesses públicos, se o senhor sai otimista ou pessimista com a situação do Brasil hoje?
Oh, I live much more optimistic. As I say, it's a moment of, you might say, almost celebration, that being freed of Bolsonaro was like being freed in America from Trump. But you have even a leader who is even more expressive of the need to address the problems of inequality. His challenge is very much like President Biden's challenge, a Congress that is divided, even though in the U.S., officially the Democrats control the Senate. Critical Democrats who claim to be Democrats are much more centrist. So he's had an enormously difficult political role. And, you know, President Lula says it's not only what you say, it's what you can do that's important. And he's been able to do a lot, and I'm very hopeful at this point he'll be able to do even more.
É isso, nosso tempo chegou ao fim. Eu agradeço imensamente ao professor Joseph Stiglitz por ter incluído o Roda Viva na sua agenda brasileira. Obrigada também a essa bancada que conduziu a entrevista comigo, Alex Ribeiro, Jefferson Nascimento, Laura Carpusca, Vilma Pinto, Vinícius Torres Freire, Leslie Cohen e Luciano Veronese. Obrigada a você pela sua audiência semana a semana. Os consensos econômicos têm sido sacudidos pelas consequências da globalização para a democracia, no mundo do trabalho e também na correlação de poder no mundo. Além disso, eventos como a pandemia e o avanço da emergência climática colocaram definitivamente a discussão sobre desigualdade, por muitas décadas negligenciada pelos economistas liberais, no centro do debate público. Hoje nós tivemos o privilégio de ouvir detidamente um dos precursores em apontar que quando o crescimento e prosperidade são para 1% em detrimento de 99%, isso não é sustentável e vai explodir em algum momento. Um daqueles programas que já nascem históricos e vão enriquecer o acervo único do Roda Viva. A gente volta na próxima segunda-feira, como sempre, às 10 da noite. Eu espero você de novo. Até lá!